This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
The test will be whether Biden will support the African Union's capacity to be stronger in its peacekeeping forces. And I think there is a good chance that he will, which Trump would not even entertain a question about.
That was John Stremlau, a former career diplomat in Africa, on the differences between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump's policies toward Africa. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. The African Center for the Study of the United States was recently established in Johannesburg, South Africa. A former top U.S. government official says this is a sign of the continent's intense interest in American affairs following the rule of Donald Trump and his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden. Darren Taylor reports.
John Stremlau, a former director of policy planning for the U.S. Secretary of State, describes Biden as an elderly, white, Catholic, Irish American. As such, says the current professor of international relations at Johannesburg's Wits University, Biden has a freer hand to work with Africa than America's first black president, Barack Obama, did. Stremlau's convinced that Obama, whose father was a Kenyan, and who Biden served as vice president, couldn't be seen to be giving special treatment to Africa. So his African ancestry actually curtailed how far he could take his relationships and cooperation with the continent. Stremlau says Biden's actions so far should encourage Africa.
In short, he's my kind of politician. And already he has achieved a remarkable amount in changing the tenor and substance of U.S. politics for the better. With legislative achievements, executive actions, and appointments, the most diverse cabinet in history, and 11 new judges that include Asian and African-American women, and the first Islamic federal judge.
Stremlau believes the U.S. could learn from Africa, the world's most ethnically diverse continent, but also, like America, a region of extreme inequalities.
Biden's effort to tackle inequalities and social justice would have corporations pay their fair share in taxes, especially those that hide profits overseas. And that is very much in sync with the African Union ECA high-level panel on illicit financial flows that Thabo Mbeki chairs. And that's a promising area for joint inquiry.
But he adds Biden won't have much time for Africa's autocrats.
The desire to transcend the old images of Africa, it seems to me to be quite real in Biden's case, but he is going to emphasize democracy. If he can have a partnership with African democracies, including South Africa, Ghana, others that are struggling to consolidate democratic experiments, I think that will be very much in his interest to do so, while at the same time...
There's a lot of speculation in Africa about how the Biden administration is going to approach the continent's many regional conflicts. Well, says Stremlau, Biden is at least interested in them.
He sent his closest Senate colleague, a fellow Delawarean, to Ethiopia as his personal envoy and is trying to figure out a way to work with others in calming down the Ethiopian situation. And right next door in Mozambique, the special forces are present to try to counter the extremists that are caused such...
He says the president clearly realizes African problems must have African solutions.
The test will be whether Biden will support the African Union's capacity to be stronger in its peacekeeping forces. And I think there is a good chance that he will, which Trump would not even entertain a question about. One thing you can say for sure, that Biden does not want to get sucked into regional conflicts that which America would be, as it was in Iraq, the lone ranger.
Stremlau says Biden's commitment to diplomacy bodes well for Africa and could result in cooperation in important areas.
Climate change also is representative of a new cluster of global issues along with COVID-19, such as food insecurity, biological warfare, and other threats. Biden views it as another opportunity, these global challenges, for development and for the basis of multilateral cooperation.
He says, unlike Trump, who sometimes spoke of developing nations in very insulting terms, Biden has a caring vision and also realizes that instability and deprivation elsewhere in the world have the potential to harm America. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The governments of the United States, China, and various Western European nations say they intend to switch cars' traditional reliance on fossil fuels to electricity. This is supposed to mitigate climate change and help out businesses, but what will the transition mean for Africa? VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Michael Ross, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, to find out.
It'll have enormous implications for Africa. There's a number of countries that depend heavily on exports of oil and natural gas to keep their economies going. Nigeria, Angola, Congo Brazzaville, South Sudan, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, and so on. And these countries tend to have oil that is not particularly cheap to extract.
So what does that mean?
What that means is, as demand goes down globally for petroleum, places where it's more expensive to take it out of the ground are going to see demand drop much more quickly. And the governments are going to have a lot less money, and it's going to be much harder for them to pay their bills. And they're going to have to find other ways to produce jobs and fund their governments and fund public services.
You mentioned before that mineral wealth is both a blessing and a curse when it comes to Africa. How might that also be the case when so much of the world changes over to electric vehicles from gas?
Countries that have abundant sources of so-called critical minerals, the minerals that are rising in demand as we move toward electric vehicles, they're going to see a big increase in the demand for what they mine. And that potentially means new investment, jobs, government revenues will potentially give governments the opportunity to provide more services, but also probably fund a lot more corruption and could cause political fortunes in those countries to get worse.
But there'll be lots of job loss along the way for workers in the oil fields and other places in the petroleum industry.
Well, the good thing about the minerals industry is that it tends to employ more people. And so there are going to be more people who directly benefit. And for better or worse, mining happens on land. A lot of oil extraction takes place offshore. So you're going to have both more opportunities for local peoples to benefit from new infrastructure, from jobs, from providing services to companies that are working in these areas, but also more environmental degradation and potentially more land disputes and more human rights abuses. So it's kind of a mixed picture.
You mentioned the DRC as an example.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has a long history of political instability, political repression, and is by and large a country that is not likely to spend the money well. So we should be pretty suspicious about what the larger consequences will be. And it's possible that in countries that have strong governments and where people have some ways of holding their governments accountable might benefit. They might indeed get a larger share of the proceeds. But that's a country-to-country struggle, and often it's an uphill battle for citizens to claw some of these benefits out of their governments and out of the hands of the international companies that are operating there.
Historically, there hasn't been a lot of transparency over how the money that's made from these resources, minerals and oil, et cetera, is spent or where it goes.
Yes, that's right. The whole extractive sector, oil, gas, minerals, timber, is clouded by very high levels of secrecy. People don't have the opportunity to find out who's really benefiting. But when the secrecy is peeled back every once in a while, we see all kinds of sweetheart deals, all kinds of corruption with these contracts. So it's not inevitable, but we need to, I think, start from a position of wariness about the benefits that flow to everyday citizens. And Africa's oil wealth has been the entry point for all kinds of pernicious foreign influences ever since the colonial era. And it's one reason why their resources are as often a curse as a blessing. They're undoubtedly a blessing for the governments and the people in power who can capture a large share of it. But it's much rarer that the people on the ground actually benefit.
That was Professor Michael Ross, a political scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Nigeria's armed forces have dismissed suggestions that they should take over from President Muhammadu Buhari, sparking new political debates about worsening insecurity. Shortly after the military issued the statement yesterday, the Office of the Presidency said it was aware that, quote, some disgruntled religious and past political leaders, end quote, were planning to, quote, compel a forceful and undemocratic change of leadership, end quote. The military leadership said it would continue to protect the country's democracy as well as its territorial integrity and the safety of citizens. Nigeria has battled the Boko Haram insurgency in the northeast for more than a decade and has recently seen a rise in kidnappings by militants and bandits for ransom, as well as fighting among herding communities and farmers. In addition, there are separatist tensions in the southeast. In the past few months, hundreds of people, chiefly children, have been kidnapped and scores killed. Nigerian newspapers report opposition parties describe the presidency's allegations of anti-government plots as baseless and an overreaction to legitimate criticism of Buhari's handling of the surge in violence. Nigeria has a history of military rule. Buhari himself, as an army brigadier, led a coup in 1983. The military handed over power to a civilian government in 1999, and Buhari was elected president in 2015, then re-elected in 2019. UN agencies are reporting a sharp rise in deaths across the central Mediterranean among refugees and migrants fleeing conflict, persecution, and economic hardship in their home countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
So far this year, say UN agencies, at least 500 people have lost their lives at sea trying to reach Europe via the dangerous central Mediterranean route. This is compared to 150 sea fatalities in the same period last year. An estimated 130 people died in a shipwreck off the Libyan coast last month. A report by the International Organization for Migration blamed their deaths on the failure of maritime rescue vessels to respond to their calls of distress. The spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency, Carlotta Sami, says fortunately the distress calls of some 1,500 others who recently made this perilous journey were heeded. She says more than 1,000 disembarked in the port of Trapani in Sicily on May 1st, following rescue by the Italian Coast Guard. She says she was present to watch more than 450 other refugees and migrants rescued by the NGO vessel Sea Watch come ashore on Tuesday. Most of the arrivals, she says, departed from Libya on board flimsy, unseaworthy vessels and made repeated distress calls.
We have noticed a high presence of minors, many of whom are unaccompanied. The majority of arrivals originate from Mali and the Sahel, West Africa area, Eritrea, and North Africa. Many of the people making the sea crossing come from refugee-producing countries.
Sami says many are fleeing from war and conflict, like in the Africa's Sahel region. Many others are fleeing persecution and being trafficked and sold like commodities. She says the latest disembarkations in Italy bring the number of sea arrivals this year to more than 10,400. This, she notes, is more than a 170% increase compared to the same period in 2020. She says the UNHCR and partners are working with the government of Italy at disembarkation points to help identify the needs of new arrivals and to support the reception system for asylum seekers.
We gather in the past few days several testimonies also from minors that are speaking of imprisonment and brutalities with no respect for human life in Libya, while also survivors are suffering mental health issues.
The UNHCR is urging the international community to strengthen protections for migrants and refugees trying to cross the Mediterranean and to provide safe alternatives to these dangerous journeys. The agency is calling on states to expand legal pathways such as humanitarian corridors, evacuations, resettlement, and family reunification. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the past week, Libyan rebel General Khalifa Haftar, who is the commander of the Libyan National Army, met with the UN envoy to Libya, John Kubis, along with the deputy head of the Presidential Council, Moussa Al-Koni, in Al Rajma, eastern Benghazi. Wolfgang Putzai, a former Austrian military attaché to Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the future of Haftar and prospects of success in gradually reaching a peaceful settlement in Libya.
One needs to talk with the LNA commander Haftar if one wants to unify the Libyan army and the Libyan national army. If one wants to talk about security in the south, one needs to take into account that the only one military forces present in southern Libya belong to Haftar's Libyan National Army. So I would say, while Haftar is currently pretty much outside of the political discussion about the way ahead for Libya, it is really understandable that Kubis and Al-Koni include him into any efforts about these two issues, about the reunification and security in the south. They are aware that he has the loyalty of the LNA. But for regarding his future, I don't see a political role for him under the current circumstances. I would also say it is rather unlikely that Haftar will run for presidency in the December elections. He would certainly not be a unifying figure, but a unifying figure is exactly what Libya needs right now.
With the complicated situation in Libya right now, what are the prospects of achieving the goal of holding elections on time, leading to some sort of a peaceful settlement for the conflict?
The elections scheduled for December are probably not a very good option, but I don't see a better one. So the elections should be for another interim government, as there is no way to get a broadly accepted constitution in place before. It is not even realistic to re-implement the former, the old one, Libyan constitution, as this would also take some time. The electoral law should reflect all this, and it is key to motivate as many Libyans as possible to register for the elections and to go to vote. The recent participation in the local elections was way below 20%, and this does not really give a democratic legitimacy for the outcome. Widespread election fraud is the place during these local elections. So international supervision, maybe including something like remote cameras, would be required. It is necessary to remember that the 2014 elections were one of the main triggers of the subsequent civil war, and this always must be kept in mind. The risk of a new war is even before December still here. And I would say the only way to prevent such a new escalation and to open also the coastal road, which is still closed, although there were many promises, is a real consolidation of the ceasefire by establishing an efficient UN monitoring mission. Although there is already a UN resolution mandating a first footprint of such a mission, there is not much movement on the ground.
That was Wolfgang Putzai, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. A video found on social media today shows a French journalist who says he was kidnapped in Mali last month by a militant group linked to Al-Qaeda. News outlets could not verify the media, but the press freedom group Reporters Without Borders says Olivier Dubois was snatched while working in the city of Gao. The French Foreign Ministry also confirmed his abduction and said it was in contact with the family and Malian officials. In the video, Dubois says he was abducted on April 8th by the group to support Islam and Muslims, which is a large alliance of Islamist extremists in the Sahel region. Separately, a woman from Mali has given birth to non-uplets, 5 girls and 4 boys, in a Moroccan hospital. Mali's government flew 25-year-old Halima Cisse to Morocco for care in March after doctors said tests indicated she was expecting 7 babies. She gave birth yesterday by cesarean section, and there were 2 more babies than expected. Mali's health minister said Cisse and the babies were doing well, but would not return home for several weeks. Births of non-uplets are extremely rare. We wish Miss Cisse and her 9 babies all the best. Gambia's Supreme Court has voided a move by Parliament to let legislators and their staff take out personal million-dollar loans. They amended the country's budget last year to add in an allocation to fund the loans. As reporter Pandari Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, pro-democracy activists are hailing the court's ruling.
The court ruled yesterday that the loans are unconstitutional, saying Parliament overstepped its bounds. The court ordered that any loans that already have been disbursed must be returned immediately. Fasamba Jau is among the Gambian pro-democracy activists hailing the ruling.
Well, I think it's a great thing for our evolving democracy, because definitely here we see a court that was able to do its job by interpreting the Constitution. This move by the National Assembly to allocate itself $54 million loan scheme was one of the most unpopular moves by the National Assembly. It was really decried by a lot of Gambians, and we believe that it was done unconstitutionally.
The lawsuit was filed by the civil society organizations and the Center for Research and Policy Development.
The ruling by the Supreme Court is a great affirmation by the concerns that we have, and also a demonstration that at least our democracy is evolving, and this separation of powers, where at least one of them, the legislative body, is being checked by the judiciary, so that we will not have any violation of our laws.
Jau says the National Assembly never heeded concerns that were raised by the legislature that only the executive branch has the right to formulate the budget.
So what the National Assembly did was it overstepped its boundaries. Yes, it has the powers of oversight, but it does not have the powers to allocate, like to draw a budget, a fresh budget line. That's not their role.
Jau was asked what message the ruling sends.
The teachable moments are that it is absolutely important that whatever action is taken in our governance structure is done in accordance with the laws of the country, because we cannot be going outside of the law to do such things.
UK-based Gambian political scientist Dr. Ibrahim Asise hailed the ruling and the activists for their commitment in safeguarding the country's newfound democracy. For VOA News, this is Pandari Mbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
In our next story, we meet Kenyan woman Joyce Kago. Her three marriages ended when she couldn't have children. That left her alone and struggling to make ends meet. Kago is one of many childless women in Kenya, where having children is often seen as a key to being accepted by society. Rude Elmendorp reports from Thika, Kenya.
We're in the Meriva Wellness Rehabilitation Center in Thika, northeast of Nairobi. Here in the kitchen, Joyce Kago cooks as if it was for her family. She's cutting onions on a plastic chopping board. Kago, who's 57, was married three times, but the marriages fell apart because she was unable to have children. Her last marriage ended 4 years ago when her husband became abusive.
And then the husband started to drink. When he came, he beat me. He tell me, what are you doing here? There is nothing I'm benefiting from you.
As elsewhere in the world, the societal shame of being childless in Kenya is directed most heavily toward women, but not entirely. Dr. Kireki Omanwa is the chairman of the Kenya Obstetrical and Genealogical Society.
Our society, usually parents are sort of identified with the children that they have born. You are called mama so and so. So mama and then the name of the child that you have born. Or you are baba so and so. Baba meaning father, and the child that you have born. So if you don't have a child, then you are ostracized.
Adding to the shame, Kenya's Obstetrical and Genealogical Society says one of the biggest causes of infertility among 5 million adults is sexually transmitted infections. We're in the office of the Waiting Wombs Trust. It was founded in 2017 by Edita Hadassa to help childless women like herself to cope.
So the first thing we strive to do is to just create a space where you're free to vent, talk about it. We listen without judging. We allow you to cry if you want to. We say it's a place where we offer free hugs.
The group has grown from 100 women 5 years ago to over 10,000. For women like Kago, Waiting Wombs Trust is truly like the family they never had. Ruth Elmendorf for VOA News, Thika, Kenya.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mukbil Yabaro, and our editor, Paul Alexander, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy.